New York? There's a grubby harbor.
I know you.
Then what's it smell like?
Like rocks? Like an empty house with all the windows blowing open? Like thinking? Like tears? Like November?
What about the tree?
It's the part that goes on living.
Are you cold?
No, here.
Thanks.
I'm never going to leave you, Kathleen.
Don't ever leave me.
I never will.
November 1st, 1918. Caro Diario, this is my swan song. It's happened. I am too happy to write any more. There is one last event to record before I kiss and close you forever. Today, the Kaiser took me to the Metropolitan Opera House. Custodian let us in. All is calm, all is dark, awaiting the opening night of the season on November 11th. The custodian raised the gold curtain, and I stood center stage on the set of Samson and Delilah and looked into the house. Beyond the pit, the dress circle and orchestra swept out before me, a varnished sea of gilded red rushing to the back and sides of the house to meet balcony upon balcony, fanning up and around me like the decks of a grand seagoing vessel. 3,465 passengers, not counting the crew. This afternoon, there was an audience of two. Rose and the Kaiser. Center orchestra. I sang Quando Menvo from Bohème and received a standing ovation. I'll sing Fergati Casazza on the 12th. I'll make my debut on this stage this time next year. But I had my maiden voyage today. Oh, diary, my loyal friend, there is love, there is music, there is no limit, there is work, there is the precious sense that this is the hour of grace when all things gather and distill to create the rest of my life. I don't believe in God. I believe in everything. And I am amazed at how blessed I am. Thank you. Love, Liebe, Amore. Kathleen Cecilia Piper. Book 9. The Family Tree. The sands of Mecca shape a rose. The Thief of Baghdad. The inscription in the stone archway says, Ora pro nobis. So Lily does, folding her hands on the diary in her lap and bowing her head. She has been sitting here for the past hour, reading in the doorway opposite 85 1/2 135th Street. She is glad, after all, that the mission lady found her, because, although her dress and boots are worse for wear, Lily's hair is clean and silky and her face is shining. Across the street, the church is still on the second floor, with four new stained-glass windows. The Holy Bible closed, the Holy Bible open. Jesus standing attended by sheep. Jesus sitting attended by sheep. The butcher shop is likewise there, renamed Harlem's Own Community Green Grocer and Butcher Shop. But Dash Daniel's Harlem Gentleman's Emporium has been replaced by Joyce and Coralie's Beauty School, Bonaparte System. The A2Z Auto School, Renaissance Bookstore, Johnson's Photo Studio, Johnson's Barber Shop, and R.W.J. Johnson Notary Public. There are nests like this everywhere of buildings richly subdivided, bursting with busyness and smart signage, yet flanked by those boarded up and empty, danger, keep out. The survivors seem to be clinging to each other for warmth, hoping to avoid the next sweep of the scythe through a neighborhood where at one time there seemed never to be enough space to house the dreams, the energy, the buzz of enterprise and thunderclaps of faith and music. More and more, Harlem depends on the tourist trade. The harder times get, the higher they get up here at a movable feast of dingy wang-dangs and a string of glittering clubs where genius enters by the back door. Lily watches three little boys in fedoras and long coats, gathered round a wooden crate playing a mysterious game. A woman dressed like some type of nun passes by and scowls at her, then does a double take and says, "God bless you." Little girls skip rope. There are children everywhere. For a while now, the butcher has been leaning in his doorway across the street, considering Lily. He is a good-looking man of about 30, and he calls, "Are you waiting for someone?"
"No, sir,"
he smiles.
"Who's your mama, girl? Where's she at?"
Lily smiles back. Not since Cape Breton has she heard words to that effect.
"She's dead."
He nods.
"You hungry? You look hungry."
"It's all right, thank you. I'm expected."
Lily rises, crosses the street and walks past him up the steps, through the stone archway and into the cool vaulted foyer. Up the stairs, her brace ringing out on the worn white marble, second floor church on the left. Lily pops her head in just to see what a Baptist church looks like. Three older ladies are cleaning and yakking, but stop dead when the oldest one looks up to see Lily's head inquiring around the door and screams the way anyone would if the devil showed up in church. The other two women cry, "Sweet Jesus! Dear Redeemer on the cross!" They would bless themselves, but they're not Catholic. Lily withdraws.
"Excuse me."
The bravest lady steals over to the door and watches Lily climb toward the third floor. Then she turns to her cronies and explains,
"That red-haired devil who ruined our Miss Rose has come back to life as a shrunk-down, raggedy cripple."
"It's true."
Third floor. Open doors. A gauntlet of staring faces, mostly children. An old young woman on the verge of barking out the usual interrogation till she sees it's a lame girl. Hostility is replaced by curiosity. Lily makes her lopsided way in a wake of whispers, and one giggle followed by the sound of a slap. Apartment 3. Lily knocks and waits. Turning to her audience, now silent, she smiles. The old young woman shoos the kids back into her apartment and slams the door. Lily knocks again. She knows there's someone home. She can hear a piano, soft, one-handed, as though that hand had fallen asleep and were now dreaming. She knocks a third time, and finally gets a muffled reply.
"Fuck off."
Lily puts her mouth to the crack of the door and formulates politely, "Miss Lacroix,
it's Lily Piper. I've come to visit you, and I have something for you."
Silence. Lily waits. It's a long silence, but far from empty. Finally, the scrape of a chair. Slow, firm footfalls. A voice just on the other side of the door says,
"There's no Miss Lacroix here."
Lily waits. The door opens. A man looks down at her. His face is all angles, handsome and severe. He's perhaps a bit too lean. Black hair shorn to the scalp, long neck, white shirt open at the throat. His baggy black trousers are worn to a shine. His impossibly articulated hands dangle, waiting to get back to their real life. But his eyes say he's forgotten music for the moment. Lily waits while he looks and looks. One of his hands rises and a finger touches Lily's forehead, traces her eyelid, cheeks, lips, chin. The man is crying. Lily asks,
"May I come in?"
She enters when the man steps back. He closes the door behind her, and she stands in the middle of the room, looking round. There is a piano bench, one chair, and a table. Lily turns back to the man and says, "Hello, Rose." Rose takes a half step toward her. Lily approaches. Rose puts forth her hands, slowly fingering the air as though searching for something in a dark wardrobe. Lily enters the embrace. When Rose shakes and shudders, Lily does not let her stumble. While Rose grieves, Lily takes more and more weight. She has held people up before when they were stricken, and besides, she is in good shape from her walk. Rose soaks Lily's neck and shoulder and groans into her ear as though something jagged and wrong were being drawn out of her body. She moans, "Oh, no, no, no." Because for Rose, it has just happened. It's important to attend funerals. It is important to view the body, they say, and to see it committed to earth or fire, because unless you do that, the loved one dies for you again and again.
"No, no, no."
Lily pats Rose gently on the back, the way you would a baby. Rose whimpers into her shoulder.
"I'm sorry."
But what has she to be sorry for? A body doesn't need a reason to feel sorry. Sorry is a free-floating commodity.
"I love you," says Rose.
"I know."
"Never leave you."
"It's okay."
"Kathleen."
The word becomes a keening, and Rose crumples in agony at the extraction of that last mortal shard. It's the one that hurts the worst. She tried to leave it where it was so it could kill her slow and numb, that last lethal fragment. Her name. Lily guides Rose to the floor, retching, past crying, until finally she begins to rock on her heels.
"It's okay. It's all right now, Rose."
And Rose takes her first unfettered breath. Lily has made tea. She pours some hot into Rose's cup and asks,
"Why didn't you save her?"
Rose could retreat to her usual safe, cynical distance. But at this moment, she can't remember what she ever had to lose or gain. She answers the question.
"I wrote and my letters came back unopened. I figured to hell with her. That's 'cause I wanted to think she was the one sending them back. I couldn't believe anyone could lock her up, even though I'd seen her father."
Lily doesn't ask. Rose stirs and stirs her tea, looking down until she picks up the thread again.
"She always did what she wanted, you see. That was the great thing. It was better to think she was finished with me than to think anything could get the better of her. I thought, give her a couple months. She'll be back. Her brilliant career, you know. She could quit me, but not her music."
Rose looks up.
"But she didn't come back. By the time I got money for a train ticket to that what-the-hell island..."
"Cape Breton."
"Yeah."
Smiling.
"Cape Breton. Giles found me and told me she was dead. Never said nothing about babies. Said flu."
Rose looks out the window at a line of small clothes. Lily says,
"You could have walked."
"Yeah, I could have walked."
They sit in silence for a bit. Then Lily asks,
"What's the date today?"
"I don't know. June something. 21st? No, 20th.
"It's my birthday."
Rose squeezes shut her eyes for a moment, then opens them. Her voice is kind when she speaks.
Happy birthday, Lily.
I'm supposed to be at Lord's.
You don't say.
There's a charcoal fedora with an emerald band hanging from a hook on the back of the door. Lily goes and gets it and hands it to Rose.
Would you play me something?
Rose sets the hat beside her on the bench and plays. When there is finally more silence than music, Lily looks up and says,
"Thank you."
Rose returns to her cold tea and watches as Lily unbuckles her brace, pulls off her boots, and turns them upside down on the table. A wadded heap. When the maple leaves wore out, Lily lined the sole of her left boot with newspaper photos of President Roosevelt because she trusted him, and reinforced her right sole with promises of a new deal. The rest of the wrinkled papers on the table bear the likeness of King George V, which is why it takes Rose a moment to recognize the fact of $3,000 in hundreds.
"What do you figure it's worth in American money?" asks Lily.
"Where the hell'd you get this, child?"
Lily answers.
"My sister Frances."
Rose nods and smiles and says,
"Everybody should have a sister Frances."
St. Anthony, patron saint of lost objects. The beautiful color print of Bernadette and Our Lady of Lourdes has been nicely framed. It hangs over the blackboard in Mercedes' classroom at Mount Carmel High School. Mercedes never tires of telling the wonderful story of Bernadette, nor does she let many weeks go by without quizzing the class at random. "And how many times did Our Lady appear to Bernadette?" Bernadette is a saint now. She was canonized on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, December 8, 1933, the year Lily went away.
"And what did Our Lady answer when Bernadette asked, 'Who are you?'"
Mercedes stands ramrod straight on her platform at the front of the class, anticipating the 40s in her economy of line and preference for angles. April, 1939.
"What's wrong with this sentence?"
She raps the blackboard with her pointer, taut hickory, parade square quality. Chalked in her textbook longhand, "Do like your mother says." Her grade tens, 17 of them. God knows there'll be few enough by the time they hit grade 12, and likely not a single boy among the graduating class. Only three left now. One of them, Bernie Moose Muse, shoots up his hand. Mercedes casts a withering eye and purses her lips, unaware that this has made her an easy schoolyard takeoff.
"Who am I? Old Leather Lips."
"Well, Bernard?"
"See, miss, it's like this. If every girl did like her mother said, the population of Cape Breton Island would be cut in half."
A burst of laughter, bitten off and swallowed short by the class. Nervous titters as Mercedes strolls to the big boy's desk. He's grinning. Actually kind of fond of Old Leather Lips. The blows rain down on him hard and fast, a hickory blur. Before he can get his arms over his head, he's bleeding from an eye, occasioning a new nickname.
"You need a bit of a rest, Mercedes."
"Yes, Sister St. Eustace."
"Perhaps a brief change of scene."
"I have friends in Halifax."
Halifax County.
"Anthony, come here, please."
The matron at the Nova Scotia Home for Colored Children waits with her hands folded as the little boy throws a last clutch of grain to the hens. This is Mercedes' first trip to the mainland. She stands next to the matron. The little boy wears a red checkered shirt and brown corduroy pants with suspenders. Sturdy boots. He looks healthy. The matron picks a little straw from his hair and says,
"Anthony, this is Miss Piper."
The little boy looks down on the bashful side and says,
Hello?
Hello, Miss Piper, prompts the matron.
Hello, Miss Piper.
Mercedes waits till he looks up. Then she begins. Who made the world? He hesitates, parts his lips, then.
God made the world.
Who is God?
God is the creator of heaven and earth and of all things.
What is man?
Man is a creature composed of body and soul and made to the image and likeness of God.
Why did God make you?
God made me to know him, to love him, and serve.
And to serve?
And to serve him in this world, and to be happy with him forever in heaven.
What must we do to save our souls?
To save our souls, we must worship God by faith, hope, and charity. That is, we must believe in him, hope in him, and love him with all our hearts.
Heart.
Heart.
Mercedes nods. That is all. You may go, Anthony.
The little boy watches as Mercedes turns to walk away with the matron. Then he stops her with a question.
Are you the nice lady?
Mercedes turns back, at a loss.
The matron helps. The nice lady who sent you here and makes sure you have clothes and food? Yes.
Mercedes remains expressionless.
Anthony says, Thank you, Miss Piper.
And scoots, tickled and shy, back to the chickens.
Lovely farm,
says Mercedes to the matron. Come, I'll show you the school section.
Mercedes arranged for Anthony to be sent here before he was born. The first Nova Scotia home for colored children blew up along with half of Halifax in 1917, but they built another one out on the Preston Road. Mercedes did not expect Anthony to grow up as a charity child, even though this is a charity organization, courtesy of the African United Baptist Association. Some of the best women you'd ever want to meet on the ladies' auxiliary. There are even music classes. Anthony is learning violin. Mercedes pays for him out of the Lord's money, asking only that he be raised a Catholic. The Baptist ladies have been as good as their word, as Mercedes ascertained just now. He is 6 years old. Mercedes can see there is no devil in him. He has his mother's eyes. Armistice Day.
Of wicked and most cursed things to speak I now commence. Ye daughters and ye parents, all go, get you far from hence. Or if ye minded be to hear my tale, believe me not in this behalf, nor think that such a thing was ever wrought.
Ovid, Metamorphosis, Book 10. Myrrha and Cinyras. James got a letter from an anonymous well-wisher. He left that night. 3.5 days later, at 6:05 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, he walked out of Grand Central Station. He walked all the way to where she was staying in Greenwich Village because he couldn't get a cab. There were crowds. He knocks, but no one answers. The apartment door is unlocked, in fact, slightly ajar when he arrives. He pushes it open and calls, but no one answers. He enters the little vestibule and listens.
Hello? Anybody home?
He looks into the old lady parlor.
Giles! Kathleen!
Quiet as the grave. He sets down his small black case, cocks his head to a sound, giggling.
Removes his hat and hangs it on the hall tree. A shriek and muffled laughter from
across the parlor, down the hall. The smell of lavender, past the WC, treading softly. A closed door.
He hovers.
He places his ear to the panel of opaque glass. It's Kathleen making those sounds. Impossible to see through the wavy glass. Shadows.
He closes a hand over the china knob. Pink rosebuds in milk. turns silently, opens the width of a human eye, sees. Spray of red-gold hair upon the pillow. His daughter's hands traveling over a black back, disappearing beneath the waistband of a pair of striped trousers moving between his daughter's bare thighs. His daughter's voice, and not her voice.
Oh, oh, oh.
A roar of blood behind his eyes, and he's in the room. Yanks the bastard off her with one arm to belt him across the face with the other and fling him into the wall. His daughter leaps naked at his back because he is going to kill her lover with the flat of his foot. But no, James would never kill a woman. Arms up to cover herself. Bleeding mouth, sliding down the wall. Jesus! James tears the spread from the bed, descends upon the dazed girl, enveloping her as though she were in flames. Slings her from the room, down the hall, out into the corridor where he flings her, a mummy sack of bones. Then he locks the door and slides the safety chain into place. In the bedroom, his daughter is crying, pawing the floor for her clothes. Why, Kathleen? He is not feeling angry. She looks up, a blind, choking mess. He puts a hand down to her. She takes it, legs shaking badly, onto her feet, clutching the floor mat for cover.
Why?
The back of his hand.
Why?
His speeding palm.
Why?
Closed fist. Her head comes to rest facing forward, already puffing up. He looks at what he has done. He takes her in his arms. She is racked with shame. Just wants some clothes, please.
Shh, shh, shh,
he says, kissing her hair, her injured face. It's his own fault. I never should have let her go far from home. An ecstasy beneath his hands. It's all right, my darling.
Don't,
she says. He can't speak just now. He loves her too much.
Closer. Oh, so soft. Daddy!
He will tell her after how much he loves her. Her palms against his shoulders, fighting to stay on her feet.
Oh, my darling.
Falling, fists against his back, enmeshed between his weight, the mushy bed. Struggling only shakes the web. The sheet and all its threads conspire. She can no longer find her feet. The iron taste of her mouth where he's made it bleed. Dreadful sorry. I'll take you home again.
Be still,
he pleads.
Stop it!
I'll never let anyone hurt you again.
No!
Never let anyone touch you.
No!
No one, no one, no one will ever, ever. She has stopped screaming.
Hurt you, ever.
She is lying perfectly still now.
Again.
He shudders.
Shh, 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 shh.
It's all right now.
Hush, my darling.
It's all right. James unhooks the safety chain and lets Giles in.
Hello, Giles.
Who? Excuse me.
I'm sorry, it's James.
James!
He takes her net bag of groceries and helps her off with her coat.
James! What, I haven't seen you since...
A little flustered.
Was I... Am I forgetting?
No, no, I'm here unannounced. Thought I'd look in, see how the world-famous singer's making out.
He smiles and blinks twice in quick succession.
Does Kathleen know you're here?
Suddenly alarmed, lest,
yes, oh yes, we've already had a visit,
says James. Giles starts down the hall.
Kathleen, dear.
James stops her.
She's having a bit of a nap, not feeling too spry.
Oh, Giles hesitates. Oh, dear. Did you meet Rose?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Giles strip-searches his face, then says, I'll just look in on the girl. She's sleeping, really. Look, I've made myself useful. There's a pot of tea and two cups set out in the tiny dining room. Oh, well, that's lovely, James. Thank you. On their way to the table, Giles chats politely. You know, I just popped out to the corner to get some... Where did I put my... James holds up the net bag.
Right here.
Oh, good. Thank you, James. Yes, I just popped out for a jiffy, but I was delayed, you know. Caught up in the celebration. Swept quite out of my way.
Oh?
Oh, yes. Haven't you heard? James gives her a sociably blank look, pours tea, his hand shaking only slightly. Giles breaks into a big papery smile. Oh, James, the war is over. This morning at 11 o'clock. Oh, wait till I tell Kathleen it's over. It's all over.
Rose fought her way through the victory crowds and holed up in Central Park till dark, ticker tape in her hair, confetti drying on her bloody face. Around 9, she walks into the apartment on 135th, past Jean, who's reading on the couch, something in French. Jean actually sits up.
What happened to you?
I got beat up, rising.
Who did this thing?
Summoning her upper-crust command.
Answer me, Rose.
Rose splashes water on her face at the kitchen sink.
Kathleen's father.
Jean swallows the smallest of canaries, then slides back into her sweet drawl.
Don't worry, honey. Mama will make it all better.
Rose watches as Jean heats water on the stove. She sits still while Jean dabs at her fat, crusty lip.
Poor baby.
Don't you want to know why, Mother?
Oh, honey, you don't have to talk right now.
Jean doesn't comment on the blood-stained bedspread or the trousers peeking out below its fringe. She picks up the phone and cancels tonight's visitor. She lights candles and lays the table for a prodigal feast. She postpones her injection.
The pain is a little better tonight.
Jean sits across from Rose and eats. She talks with well-bred animation of Rose's brilliant future. It is as though she had never left Long Island. She can almost feel the phantom servant at her right elbow poised with his crystal decanter.
You'll be more celebrated than Portia Washington Pittman, darling.
Rose does not reply, but Jean seems not to notice as she enumerates the triumphs that lie ahead. Rose will perform for royalty, as did Elizabeth Taylor Greenfield, the Black Swan. She will perform for the president, as did Sissy Aretta Jones, the Black Patty who came so close to singing at the Met. She will play with the greatest orchestras of Europe, and Carnegie Hall will be on its knees begging.
After all, Rosie, someone's got to be first, and it may as well be you.
Jean gives two pats to her lips with her linen serviette.
And Mother will be so proud of you.
She reaches out to squeeze her daughter's hand.
Not that I'm not proud already. I am, Rosie. You're my life. You're all I have left. And I love you.
Jean gives Rose her most wistful look across the candles.
Really, I do, dear.
What's the occasion, Mother? Jean looks politely baffled, but she's in too good a mood to dissemble. She is feeling girlish tonight, positively flirtatious.
She shoots Rose a Cupid's bow smile and leans forward in the candlelight.
Listen to me, my love. You have more talent in your little finger than 20 Kathleen Pipers, and one day you'll thank your pauvre petite maman.
For what?
Jean winks and lights a cigarette, inhaling with a sly eye on Rose, shaking the match well after the flame has gone out. An anonymous well-wisher. Rose begins a mental list of things to do and starts with item one.
Who was my father?
A pained smile from Jean. An unfortunate remark from her dinner guest.
Rose, dear heart, you always did love to hear the story.
I know the story. I want the truth. Jean taps her cigarette, arches her brows slightly, and sighs. Really, this is a little tiresome.
Who was he?
He was Alfred Lacroix, darling, as you perfectly well know.
And what did he do?
He was a preacher, a man of the cloth, and a credit to his race.
And where is he now?
He's in heaven, my treasure.
The catechism finished, Rose leaves the table. It's a long list. There is no time to lose.
Kathleen has gone home, Rose.
When's she coming back?
Her father didn't say.
What did she say?
Giles looks tired.
She didn't say anything.
Rose gets up.
I think I left some clothes here.
By all means, dear, have a look.
Did he hurt her?
Giles looks away. I don't know what he did. She wouldn't speak. Rose pauses, momentarily forgetting her errand.
Rose, do you need a place to stay?
Thank you, Giles. I'll be okay.
Rose stands in front of the bathroom mirror at home and cuts her hair to the scalp. She changes out of a dress for the last time, wakes up her mother and says,
I'm going now.
Jean takes a while to come out of a bad dream that starts when she opens her eyes. Rose doesn't wait, just conveys information.
I'll let you know wherever I'm playing. I'll send you money every week, whether I have it or not. When you die, I'll come back and live here.
The road starts at Club Mecca. Sweet Jessie Hogan loves spaghetti and meatballs and beer and sweet young things who tear up the keyboard and don't know when to stop. A hot blues streak. The '20s. Until Boom goes bust and Rose starts playing her own stuff. Doc Rose and his trio. A garden enclosed is my sister, spring shut up, a fountain sealed. The Song of Songs. When Francis dies, it's safe for Mercedes to put Anthony's picture on the piano. Framed in filigree silver, he stands proudly at attention in the uniform and broad trooper's hat of the Boy Scouts of the Zion African Methodist Episcopal Church. He is still a Catholic. Mercedes contemplates the cover of the record album in her lap. Francis amassed quite a collection. Ralph Lvovitz sent her one every Christmas, and whenever he visited his mother, always the same request. Francis died early this morning. The kitchen counters are still heaped with her baking. Mercedes never was a big eater, and Francis less so. Through the '30s, people came to the kitchen door and carted it away. Big stews, pork and beans by the bucket, molasses cookies, oatmeal cookies, date squares, Nellie's muffins, Johnny cake, rhubarb upside-down cake, jelly rolls, pies, blueberry grunt, yards of shortbread, hundreds of tea biscuits. Nowadays, there aren't as many people going hungry, but Francis still cooks for an army. Mercedes has had to organize pickups by the hospital, the rectory, the convent.
Young single miners have been taking care of the rest, wolfing down huge meals, hardly noticing the old girl at the oven with her 3 cigarettes on the go and her glass of Irish. Frances looked very old at the last, though she took care to henna her hair from time to time. For 20 years, Frances listened to her records. Cooked, smoked, drank, watched the street, slept on the attic floor, walked the shore. She no longer walked the shore road because it fell into the sea. They've replaced it with a paved one that runs a sensible distance from the water, but it's just not the same. She read newspapers and saved them all. Scared children without knowing. Led home cats. Tried never to change her clothes. Spoke little. And then yesterday she up and said, "Don't you ever wonder where Lily is?" And when Mercedes didn't reply, Frances got up from the sofa in the front room. "Frances, what do you need, dear? I'll get it." But Frances made her way to the piano bench and bent down, which made her cough. "Frances, dear, use your hanky." Opened it and took out her newest lung-playing record album. She handed it to Mercedes and lay back down on the sofa, exhausted. Mercedes pushed a blotched tabby off Frances's chest and looked daggers at a cross-eyed Siamese who never shut up. "Shut up," said Mercedes, and glanced down at the album cover. Duck Rose Trio, Live in Paris, Wise Child. A handsome black man. The angles of his face reprised by a fedora wound round with a gleaming emerald band. "You might want to look her up some day, Mercedes. You never know." "Why would I want to do that?" "So you can die in peace?" Mercedes hates it when Frances says things like that. She's usually so good except when she's drunk, and then Mercedes just lets her alone, shutting the door on whatever room it is so she doesn't have to hear what Frances is saying to herself. "My conscience is quite clear, Frances. Daddy died in peace." Mercedes gets up to leave and close the door. "I'm not drunk, Mercedes. I quit drinking." "Since when?" "This morning." "Oh, Frances, here, have one. I'll join you. Perk up the appetite." "I've quit. I want to die sober." Mercedes turns stony. "You're not going to die." In the schoolyard, Mercedes is no longer old Leather Lips. There is not enough affection to inspire a nickname anymore. Just fear. Everyone fears Mercedes. Except Frances. If Mercedes could have terrified Frances into going to a sanatorium, Frances would be well now. Frances could have gone to the best sanatorium money could buy, in the States, in Switzerland. But Frances refused. And Mercedes has had to watch. And now it is too late. "Damn you, Frances. How is that any different than suicide?"
"Don't be ridiculous, Frances. You're not going to die."
"Daddy died in peace because he made his confession." Frances reaches a hand to the floor for a white, blue-eyed kitten.
"He confessed to me, and I forgave him."
"You are not invested with the power to dispense the sacrament of penance."
"Yes, I am,
Frances. I don't know about you, but I'm just going to have a wee dram.
I want to make sure you know who Lily's parents were."
Mercedes covers her ears. Frances uses her last sprint of energy to pry the hands away and to speak the words. A hacking agony of basins and blood and mucus. Little songs. The 2 bright spots on Frances's cheeks. A trip upstairs to get the dolls. A story about 2 tiny girls with tartan housecoats and cinnamon toast. "I love you, Frances." A flagon of port? Or would you prefer blancmange? a kiss on the cheek, ring around the rosy.
Forgive me.
Don't cry, Mercedes.
Don't be afraid.
Will you sleep with me tonight?
Francis, remember the time you dressed Trixie up in the baptismal gown?
Don't make me laugh.
A cool cloth.
Francis, your eyes are so pretty. Always so pretty. Feel better in the morning, Habibti. Teberini.
Mercedes, remember that song?
Forgive me, Francis.
Sing it, Mercedes.
Oh, playmate, come out and play with me, and bring your dollies three. Climb up my apple tree, shout down my rain barrel, slide down my cellar door, and we'll be jolly friends forevermore.
In and out of sleep. That's right. You rest now. It's all right, Mercedes.
Forgive me, Francis.
Francis is so thin, it's no problem for Mercedes to stretch out next to her on the couch. So light in her arms like a child, so hot like coals. The terrible wheezing starts and goes on for a long time. How can such a small body make such sounds?
Don't be afraid.
All things are passing. Love never changes. Angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God's love commits me here, ever this day be at my side. Ever this day be at my side. The last of Francis leaks out her mouth warm and thick. Mercedes has never been sick a day in her life, is unafraid of disease as her father was of bullets, holds Francis all through the dawn, though her chest has stopped heaving. Stroking her damp forehead, cool now like the grass, kissing her temple no longer throbbing, a child asleep. My sister. Mercedes puts the picture of Anthony on the piano, closes the piano bench over the record album, kneels down, and folds her hands upon the lid. She asks the Blessed Virgin Mary what she must do. Sister St. Eustace attends. Mr. McIsaac attends. Mrs. Lvovitz attends. She is a widow now. Ralph and an altar boy carry the coffin. Teresa meant to keep a low profile, but it's difficult amid so few people. Mercedes pointedly ignores her.
Don't come to me asking for forgiveness.
Among Francis's absent former cohorts, there is surprise. Not that she up and died, but that...
I thought she died years ago.
At the cemetery, Mrs. Lvovitz bends and places fresh flowers on Materia's grave, as is her habit. Benny is buried at the far end in a little patch blessed by a rabbi from away. Mrs. Lvovitz comes and chats to Benny every day when she's not in Montreal. Ralph helps his mother back to her feet. Mercedes finds the sight of him indescribably sad. He is almost bald. He has a paunch and a foolish smile. Ralph is happy. He is an obstetrician. He loves his family and he survived the war. The second one. When it broke out, he joined up as a medical officer. He promised his mother he would not fight, and he didn't. Although by 1936 it was clear to Mrs. Lvovitz that, although she had always considered herself a German, Germany no longer considered her so. Nonetheless, she armed Ralph with a slew of addresses of relatives in Germany and Poland. Ralph spent the aftermath of the war treating people in DP camps, and it was there that he came to realize that the addresses his mother had given him were of no use. Now Mrs. Lvovitz squeezes her son's arm and remembers birthing the woman who is being buried today. born with the call. Mrs. Lvovitz looks at the sea and thinks,
when did this become my home? When I buried Benny here, when the Second War came.
She cannot discern the moment. She just knows that every time she returns to Cape Breton, she feels in her bones, this is my home. That is why she has declined to move permanently to Montreal. She spends half the year there. She loves her daughter-in-law, would you believe, and her 5 grandchildren, who are only each perfect. They speak French at home, English at school, and Yiddish with every second shopkeeper. Real Canadians. Mrs. Lvovitz watches the casket being lowered into the ground and says a prayer for the wild girl. She was smart. Maybe the smartest. What happened? I should have done something. Gone over there. He didn't deserve to have daughters. There was something wrong there. Mrs. Lvovitz looks east at the horizon and reminds herself of what she has learned. That nothing in life is not mixed. That it is something to know where your dead are buried. That they are buried. Little Francis. Aleha ha-shalom. Dirt hits the casket. Mercedes listens. She watches the ocean. She will go on teaching, of course. Pray for the souls of her loved ones, for their speedy release from purgatory into heaven. But who will be left to pray for her, to speed her reunion with her sister? No one, thinks Mercedes. Hopeless. Hope is a gift. You can't choose to have it. To believe and yet to have no hope is to thirst beside a fountain. Mercedes watches the ocean. Chill green today and rough. Purple farther out. She wonders when it was that she began to despair. All these years she mistook it for pious resignation. Now she sees the difference. Such a fine line between a state of grace and a state of mortal sin. What is the good of believing fervently in God if you wind up hating him? How long have I hated God? Mercedes wonders. When did I first believe it was all up to me? Which are the sins against hope? The sins against hope are presumption and despair. What is despair? Despair is the loss of hope in God's mercy. Mercedes says to herself, I am damned. Her face has eroded to shale. Her brown eyes are dry with sorrow. The ocean sorely tempts her like a lover. She longs to shave her body and walk stinging into salt, naked and anonymous, battered and embraced by rage. Nothing personal. Drown. The word is melodious, beckoning. Standing back from the gravesite, Teresa looks at Mercedes looking at the ocean and starts to pray for her. For the sake of the girl in the ground. Teresa stays and prays until everyone but she and Mercedes have left the grave and night has begun to fall. Finally, Mercedes hesitates, then turns away and walks home instead of into the ocean. That night, the Virgin Mary tells her what to do. Sudden light. I have been here before, but when or how I cannot tell. I know the grass beyond the door, the sweet keen smell, the sighing sound, the lights around the shore. Sudden Light by Dante Gabriel Rossetti. Rose is 65, ancient for a jazz man. Rock and roll reigns, and there are fewer gigs now. She has attained that thankless high status, to wit,
Doc Rose is the jazz pianist most often cited by famous jazz pianists as their favorite jazz pianist. Knowledge of Doc Rose is a litmus test of connoisseurship. The records are hard to come by now and cherished by those in the know. The rarefied fan club knows everything about Doc Rose, except that he and his manager live hand-to-mouth on 135th Street. Lily cleans churches, including the one on the second floor. Rose plays chess and checkers on the corner with the other old men. Lily has never cut her hair. It hangs down to her knees, streaked with gray. There are lightweight aluminum braces available nowadays, but she never thought to buy one when they had the money. Her face is fallen, but still sweet. Her eyes the same. She is 45. It's just after 8 on Sunday night. They're watching the Ed Sullivan Show on television when the knock comes at the door. Lily opens it, and Anthony smiles, embarrassed.
Hello, Miss Piper?
Yes?
You don't know me, although we actually have the same name. I knew your sister, Miss Mercedes Piper. My name is Anthony Piper.
Lily looks at the young man. Rose doesn't take her eyes off Topo Gigio while growling out the side of her mouth.
Someone cack and leave us money? No, I don't think so. Then go away.
Eddie, kiss me good night.
Lily says to him, Aloysius. Anthony says,
I beg your pardon?
Convinced now of his mistake. Wrong apartment. A senile old couple. Ancient smell of cabbage. Lily says, come in. He says,
you are Lily Piper?
That's right.
In or out? Make a decision.
Rose is beginning to enjoy herself. He steps in. What a day. His first time in New York City. Subway to the black metropolis, so strange and familiar, he belongs everywhere and nowhere. Anthony has experienced the feeling before. No matter where he is, there is something about people's struggles to keep their memories that bruises his heart, because it's too soft to break. The world is his orphanage. Why he should feel so sorry for the other people on the planet is a mystery to him. He's actually a very happy person. It's just that he doesn't know there's a difference between love and empathy, nor does he question why he should be overcome so frequently with nostalgia for times and places not his own. He can't see differences, only variety. He travels well. The soft heart feeds a wire frame that is never still. He plays spoons, fiddle, mouth harp, and is learning the bones from a man called Wild Archie. Odd, Archie came out of an orphanage too, whom he met at the Cape Breton Club in Halifax. Anthony is wearing desert boots, white jeans, a black turtleneck, and an afro. Slim and eager, a bright penny. Green lights in his hazel eyes.
You grew up to be happy,
says Lily. He looks at her more closely, not trusting his sense that he's met her before, which happens to him so often, as does the reverse. So familiar.
I guess you must know, he says carefully. Miss Piper passed away, quite recently.
No, I didn't know that.
Lily mourned Frances long ago, on the night she left. But she never imagined Mercedes dying, although she has prayed for her soul every night.
I'm sorry.
He hands Lily his handkerchief.
That's all right. She was my sister.
I don't know what you're blubbering for, snarks Rose. She tried to have you extradited.
Exercised.
Where am I? Thinks Anthony. And who are these people? Lily blows her nose.
Aloysius, did you know Francis? Did Francis ever get to see you?
Actually, my name is Anthony. Francis who?
What do you do for a living, Tony?
Rose, probing for a percentage.
I'm a musician.
Shit.
Shifting back to the TV.
And I teach ethnomusicology.
Rose turns up the volume.
Another damn rock and roll band from England.
Anthony is not giving up.
I should explain that Miss Piper more or less adopted me from afar, if you know what I mean. And when she died, she left me her house, and she asked me to...
Any money?
Rose's last attempt.
No, I think she spent all her money on me. I don't know why. She was a nice lady.
Our Lady of Lourdes,
says Lily.
Our Lady of Loonies,
thinks Anthony, instantly contrite.
Can't help the things that pop into his head, his love of humanity notwithstanding.
The cocoa tin, says Lily.
Cuckoo, thinks Anthony.
Then he remembers his errand. He opens his knapsack and takes out a sealed cardboard tube.
When Miss Piper died, she left me a note with your name and address, and instructions for me to give you this personally.
He hands the tube to Lily. She breaks the seal at one end and withdraws a paper scroll. She spreads it out on the table.
Anthony asks,
"What is it?"
"It's the family tree,"
Lily says.
"Look, we're all in it."
Rose flicks off the TV, scuffs over on her dilapidated slippers, fishes for her glasses.
"See?"
Lily tells Anthony.
"You have quite a few brothers and sisters. Your father's still alive, although, well, that's too bad.
Your stepmother, Adelaide, is gone."
"Leo Ginger Taylor,"
he reads aloud.
"That's your father, dear. And your Aunt Teresa, too, she's still living according to this. And look, you have a cousin, too, Adele Clare."
"I don't understand."
"There you are. There."
Lily points to the issue of Francis Euphrasia and Leo, Ginger. Sprouting from the union of their branches is his name in green ink, Anthony Aloysius.
Ambrose is there, too, twinned with Lily. And under his name the words, "died at birth." Brother and sister hang by a twig from a branch that joins James to Kathleen.
Rose looks at Lily, but Lily just folds her hands. Next to Kathleen, an equals sign joins her name to Rose's. Rose takes off her glasses.
It could be the stale air, the reeling sense of the familiar awash with the foreign, the ocean finally giving up her dead.
Anthony is suddenly seasick. "Sit down," says Lily.
He drops to his haunches and puts his head between his knees. Lily gets a cool, wet cloth from the kitchen and places it on the back of his neck.
"Breathe," she says.
He does.
That's better.
"What the hell is ethnomusicology?"
Rose wanders off to the piano. Anthony stands up carefully.
"Sorry."
"Here, dear," says Lily. "Sit down and have a cup of tea till I tell you about your mother."
This has been a Highbridge production. Copyright 1996 by Anne-Marie MacDonald. Recording copyright 2016 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.